Good afternoon. We're at the Princeton Public Library on April 21st to listen to an oral history as part of the Voices of Princeton Oral History Project in partnership with the Jewish Foundation of Jewish Community Foundation of Greater Mercer. My name is Kim Dorman, and I'm here as a facilitator in an interview with Kim Marks and Jeff Lucker.
I am Jeff Lucker, and I'm the interviewee.
And I'm Kim Marks, and I'm the interviewer. Thank you so much for being here.
Sure.
So first question, why don't we start on asking you, how did you come to Princeton?
Well, it was really sort of an accident, serendipity, if you want to call it. I was at the University of Wisconsin. I'd gotten my bachelor's degree there, my master's degree, and then I took a year of education courses, did my student teaching. And my preference was to stay in Madison. If there was a job for me at Madison Memorial High School, I would have stayed there. And my life would have turned out very differently, I guess. But there wasn't. And I applied through the Teacher Placement Bureau for a job. And I would get these little envelopes in the mail indicating openings, mostly in Wisconsin, but all over the country, mostly in the Midwest. And I wasn't particularly interested in going to a small rural community in Wisconsin. And one day this little envelope came, Princeton, New Jersey. I knew nothing about Princeton, but I knew it was near New York. I applied, got the job. It was only for 6 months, by the way. It was a leave replacement. At that time, the Princeton schools had sabbaticals. And a teacher went on sabbatical for half a year. And I was hired for that half a year. And at the end of that year, initially, they had no position for me. And at the last minute, it must have been June, a member of the department got a job out on the West Coast. There was suddenly an opening. I slipped in, and the rest is history.
Yeah. And what year was that?
1969, yeah.
So that means that you were here in Princeton during the Vietnam War.
Yes, I was, yeah.
So can you tell us a little bit about Princeton during the Vietnam War?
Well, of course, I had the perspective of teaching at the high school, where I taught for 53 years. There was a lot of student activism, a lot of student involvement, and but the big event was in the aftermath of the Kent State Massacre. There were huge demonstrations on the campus of the university. There was actually a student strike, as I recall, and one of the big issues there was that the Institute for Defense Analysis was based on the campus. And they did a lot of top secret research for the government. And the students resented the fact that they were on the campus. So they were protesting their presence on the campus. It's interesting, the director of IDA was Lee Neuwirth, who was Jewish, is Jewish, and his daughter, Bibi Neuwirth, the actress who I taught, actually. And that prompted the students at the high school to go over to the campus to join the demonstrators. A lot of them went over there and never came back for the rest of the year. So the strike permeated the high school as well. But it was a turbulent time. I mean, it motivated a lot of the students to be interested in what was going on. That was if you want to look at that positively, that was definitely a factor. Yeah.
And so when you came to Princeton in 1969, was it what you expected?
Well, I don't know that I had expectations, conscious expectations. My expectation was to have a job. But if I had any expectations, I just presumed Princeton would be like a university town that I was accustomed to. And it wasn't. In university towns like Madison, Wisconsin, I'd also been to Ann Arbor, and I'd been out to Berkeley once, and I'd been to Cambridge. The university sort of spills out physically into the town, and there's no real dividing line between the university and the community. Here in Princeton, what I discovered is what I heard one professor at Princeton describe as the DMZ, referring to Nassau Street, separating the university from the rest of the town. And as I described to you, my suspicion is the vast majority of undergraduate students at Princeton, if they get this far, never venture, they're there for 4 years, never venture further down Witherspoon Street than the public library, if that far, not further north than Hoagie Haven, and in the other direction, maybe they get as far as Morven, and that's it. They have no sense of the town because of the requirement that they reside on campus. So that was very different from what I expected. That'd be the main difference.
And now you've taught at the high school for how long?
53 years, retiring February 1st.
And what did you teach?
History. Over the years, several different courses. I used to teach U.S. history, several courses, taught a course in Latin America, Middle East. I guess the course I'm most associated with in the last couple decades is AP World History.
And what changes have you seen in the high school over those years?
Wow. You know, it's, of course, they happen gradually when you're there over a period of years, but technology, its impact on the school. I remember when I first arrived at the school, we used to have these film strip projectors, for example. And, you know, I mean, there was no internet. The principal would get in touch with you by putting notes in your mailbox instead of emailing you. It was, you know, things have changed tremendously in that respect. It's hard to know even where to begin. There have been significant changes. When I first arrived here, the school was very large. You know, a lot of people would think that the school population was much smaller. Princeton was smaller, but the school wasn't because we had a lot of sending districts. Now we have one, Cranberry. But then I think Montgomery, even Hillsborough, possibly West Windsor, all their students went to the high school. So it was quite a large school, actually. Yeah.
And being a Jewish teacher, did you find that that there were a lot of Jewish teachers on staff when you arrived or when you left?
No, there weren't. And there aren't, actually, to this day. In fact, the teacher I replaced for that half year was one of the Jewish teachers who came back, you know, at the end of that six-month period. Yeah.
And did, when we discussed before today, you said that you'd never identified yourself as Jewish as a teacher.
Right.
And you had a marvelous anecdote.
Yeah, well, main reason for that is I didn't want students to presume a bias simply because of my heritage, my religion, as I think people would tend to do, especially when you're teaching a course on the Middle East, half of which I would devote to the Arab-Israeli conflict. As a matter of fact, I, among the staff, some good friends of mine were some Palestinian teachers. But recently, just a few months ago, I was teaching a course on world religions. It was a very small class, about 10 students. And at one point, one of my students asked me, "What are you? What's your religion?" And I said, you know, very nicely, but I said, I really, you know, not reveal that. And she turned to her friend and she said, "Well, we have a pretty good idea of what you are." I said, "Well, I'd be curious to hear. We've decided you're Presbyterian and you're probably a regular churchgoer." And I just said, "You couldn't be more wrong."
Yeah. So how would you say that Princeton has changed over these 53 years?
It's changed quite a lot, and actually I think for the better. When I first arrived, one of the ways I describe it is, when I first arrived here, if you had polled my students, I don't think many of them would ever have wanted to come back here to live, because they would have said, obviously from the vantage point of a teenager, there's nothing happening here, there's nothing going on here. I think most of them would like to return here. Their fear is they wouldn't be able to for economic reasons. And they were, in a way, they were right. It was a quieter town. There were fewer restaurant options. There was less energy in the town. There was much less diversity than there is now. And a lot has changed, in those directions since I first arrived. As I was relating the other day, one good example is where I live at Queenston Common. It's a condo development. And as recently as 5 years ago, I would have described the demographics there as almost like a white retirement community. And it's just changed dramatically in the last 5 years. a lot of Asians, some African-American families, and children, a lot of children. And I've seen that happening around the town in general. And ironically, you know, talk about sort of the silver lining, I think one of the positive consequences of COVID is all this outdoor dining that's added even more energy to the town. And I think the town has become much more of a magnet for people within a 15, 25 mile radius to come here. One example of that is in the earlier years of King University, I would go and every third or fourth person I would know, a lot of people in town know me just by virtue of the fact that I've taught at the high school forever. In recent years when they had King University, I didn't know anybody. And it's simply a consequence because most of the people, a lot of them were from out of town. So it's become more and more of a magnet because of the restaurants and of McCarter and all the other things that are going on here for people to come here. So that's one of the changes I've seen.
Yeah. So speaking of McCarter, I know you have a list of some of your favorite places in Princeton over the years.
Yeah. Well, this is also in response to the question about how would I describe Princeton to someone who doesn't really know it or be interested in moving here? I would describe it as an ethnically diverse community with a lot of cultural opportunities, and among them McCarter Theater, lectures at the university, or Labyrinth Books and other that are open to the public, the Princeton Adult School, which has innumerable offerings, the Evergreen Forum, which I'm taking right now, I'm taking a course there now, the public library, an incredible library, the Garden Theater, all of those things are part of what makes Princeton a wonderful place. I think it's a great place to be retired. For me, the only drawback is the weather. And there's worse weather elsewhere,
So tell me about the Annex restaurant.
Oh, yeah. So those are a few institutions. I was just walking down Nassau Street to remind myself of its exact locations. It was a restaurant opposite Firestone Library, located in the basement of the building on the corner of South Tulane Street and Nassau Street. And you'd walk down the staircase, and it was sort of it was out of another era. It was dark, and at one end was a bar with a TV going, usually with sports on. But most of the restaurant were either tables all aligning a wall, and there was a central partition, and sort of, as I recall, sort of a worn red carpet. And it was not great food, but it was cheap. And, location, location, everybody who was anybody went there. I'd see Cornel West sitting there and well-known professors from the university, locals, everybody. It was just so convenient and easy. And it became a tradition every Tuesday night. I'd gather there with friends, all except one of them were members of the teaching community at Princeton, actually in the district. It wasn't only at the high school. The one who wasn't is the magician Teller of Penn and Teller, who's Jewish, by the way. And he was a teacher at the Lawrenceville School at the time, a Latin teacher, taught Latin. And he joined us. I can tell you a funny story about it. Even then, he was very much involved in magic. And at one of our dinners, if you want to call them that, we're sitting around on a round table, and one of my colleagues brought his young son, who asked Teller to show him a magic trick. So Teller, he took out a salt shaker, and he took a penny, as I recall, and put it under the salt shaker. And then he put a napkin over it. And he said, I want you to hit this really hard on the salt shaker and see if we can drive the penny through the table so it'll come out underneath. Hits the top of the napkin. The salt shaker comes out underneath. That's a classic kind of thing where they one-up themselves. But the most interesting part of it, I was sitting next to Teller. I wasn't supposed to see it. I was sitting right next to him. I saw how he did it. And it's one of those things where even when you know how they do it, it's amazing. It was just sleight of hand. In a flash, he just, it was a motion like that where he could just flip it underneath. But, of course, the kid was just blown away by it. And it's funny, about, it must have been 6-7 years ago, my wife and I were in Las Vegas, and we went to the Penn & Teller show there. Their permanent residence is there. And after the show, they greet the audience. They just go into the lobby, and you can just go and chat with them. So I chatted with him, and I reminded him of our dinners, and I actually have a picture of me with him. I could actually send it to you if you'd like.
Perfect.
But that's one memory I have. The other was Main Street. Main Street was at the shopping center, and where that gazebo is now, well, the restaurant was in the main part of the shopping center, but it spilled out into the warm months, like already now, especially on weekends. The gazebo was a bar, and people from all over town would go there, and I met a lot of people at Main Street. It was a great place just to sit at the bar, and there was one bartender in particular. He was one of these guys who would just, you know, he knew everybody's name, and you would be sitting down, and he'd say, "Oh, Jeff, I'd like you to meet so-and-so who's sitting next to you." And I still know people in town who are all veterans of Main Street from that period, and we really miss it. You know, it was a, it was around for quite a while. As a matter of fact, I used to go, another ritual, for dinner every Friday. I meet my wife there, and we had a couple of friends we meet also, and that's, so that became a ritual of ours as well.
So yeah. Let's talk about your wife. What was your wife's name?
Ruth Mandel, and she was a professor at Rutgers and ultimately became the director of the Eagleton Institute of Politics until the time of her death, actually.
And when did she pass?
She passed on April 11th, 2020, just a little over 3 years ago. Yeah.
And so you were telling me that she is nationally renowned in the Jewish community.
Yeah, by virtue of the fact that she, in her later years, got involved in the Holocaust Museum and was on the original Holocaust Council appointed by Bill Clinton. As a matter of fact, at home we have a big certificate, you know, where he signed it, and later on reappointed by George W. Bush. One of the perks I got out of that is I got to go to two White House dinners that she was invited to, thanks to that. As a matter of fact, at one of them, it was, the occasion was welcoming Ehud Barak, who was the prime minister, and I got to meet him and, you know, that kind of thing. Everybody was there. Anyway, but that was, yeah, she was involved in the Holocaust Museum.
And why was she involved in the Holocaust Museum? What was her connection to the
Holocaust? Her connection was that technically she was a Holocaust survivor by virtue of the fact that her family, she was born in Vienna, and at the age of 9 months, she was reputed to be the youngest passenger on the St. Louis, the ship that left from Hamburg to go to Havana, which Cuba initially agreed to take on these passengers as refugees, but turned them back. Then they went to Miami and dropped anchor offshore. They were refused entry there. They returned to Antwerp, Belgium, and divided among four countries. She had the good fortune, her family had the good fortune of going to England. Most of those who went to England survived. I think virtually all of them. Many of the others ended up in other countries where they ended up being exterminated. And as a matter of fact, she ended up living in a small town north of London called Spalding. And some years ago, she and I went and visited it, her childhood home. She lived there for 9 years and came to the United States at the age of 9, apparently with an English accent that she lost very quickly. Yeah.
So there were a few other places that you had wanted to talk about that were important to you. One was the Princeton Senior Resource Center.
Oh, yes, which I've only recently become acquainted with. It's a terrific organization, and I became aware of it through the Evergreen Forum, which is a terrific resource for senior adult education, and they offer great courses. And I just Tuesday completed a course on Shakespeare's Tragedy, given by Larry Danson, retired Princeton University professor, English department, expert on Shakespeare. And one of the things that so impressed me about it is the students. The students are just people, well, I guess largely in their 70s, but their level of engagement is just phenomenal. As a matter of fact, I came to the conclusion after this class that maybe education is wasted on the young because they're just, it's such a, it was a wonderful experience. And it's I met really interesting people. A person who I've mentioned to you, Michael Walzer, who's a world-renowned philosopher at the Institute for Advanced Study, taught a course, several courses, at the Evergreen Forum. And I ran into him and his wife recently in town, and I told him I was taking a course there. And he encouraged me to teach a course there, mentioning that one of the best things about teaching there are the students and what they bring to it. So, and as a matter of fact, last year, I went to their fundraiser. And one of the things that impressed me was how diverse that community of people was who are involved in it in terms of African-Americans and other people in the community. Yeah.
So what are the biggest events or the biggest event that you remember happening in Princeton?
Well, it's interesting. When I think of events, they're really national events, but that occurred, you know, their local impact. And one was Sandy.
Hurricane Sandy.
Yeah, Sandy. And I remember going without power for a long period of time. And school was closed and all of that. And then what I already alluded to, the Kent State strike at the university and its impact on the high school. And COVID. COVID is probably one of the biggest. And teaching on Zoom, as I did for as long as I did, and school being shut down and all of that.
How was that?
Terrible. In a word, terrible. You know, the way I've often described it, I taught for 53 years, 50 years of joy, and the last 3 years. There was one day I had finished a class on Zoom at home, you know, conducted a class, and the class had just ended, and I'm sitting in my study, and I found myself saying out loud, "I'm not enjoying this." And the joy never really returned for me after that. And even when I went back, it's had, in my view, a tremendous impact. And they're only beginning to recover from it. It's very slowly. Also, my wife died. She was home under hospice just at the peak of COVID. She had ovarian cancer, but it impacted the ability of hospice to deliver all their care the way they would normally. They did a great job, but still, that impacted that as well. Yeah.
Are there any other things that you wanted to talk about today?
I don't know.
I knew one. I'm sorry.
Sure.
You were going to talk about the one-on-one fund at the high school.
Oh, yes, yes. I've been a member for easily over 20 years. I'm the longest serving member. I'm sort of like emeritus. And for those of you who are not aware of it, the 101 Fund is it used to be called the Princeton Regional Scholarship Foundation. And we rebranded because we were confused with the Princeton, the other institution in town that is
Princeton
very similar.
Princeton Community Foundation.
Yeah, the Princeton Community Foundation. Which is a great institution also, but it's has a different mission. And so we rebranded as 101. And we grant scholarships to totally need-based to students who graduate from the high school. The only other criterion, all the students are, they're vetted for their economic need, but they're also interviewed to see if they have the commitment to follow through on a college education. I think a disproportionate number of them go to Mercer County, but not only. And I just learned this last week that one of our recipients was Evan Gerskovich, the former Princeton High School student who's presently in a Moscow prison, reporter for the Wall Street Journal. A number of Princeton Jewish residents have been active on the board, including Carol Golden, Reva Levy. I don't know if you're familiar with these names. But I've really enjoyed being involved in that, and it's a great way to get to know a cross-section of people in the community. You know, all of us are volunteers. So that's been one of the very positive experiences I've had in town. Yeah.
Are there any other things you'd like to talk about?
The only other thing that just came to mind is one of the things I like about Princeton is if you talk to a lot of people in town, one of the recollections they have of me is I was a runner, a long distance runner, and they'd see me running around town. It's a great place to be a runner because you don't have to run very far, and you're in a relatively rural area with little traffic on the roads. And a little anecdote here. Many years ago, back to school night, I should tell you a little bit about that, but on back to school night, I'm standing in front of the class just waiting for the bell to ring to begin my presentation, and a woman yelled out from the back of the room, "This is the first time I've seen you with clothes on." And what she was referring to, of course, is, I'm running in my shorts and T-shirt, and she had never seen me except that was the only context in which she had seen me. So people still, as recently as this week, I run into people in town, and I've basically stopped. I do long distance walking more, power walking, and I run on a treadmill. But anyway, it's a great place to run. Yeah.
Was there something you wanted to share about back to school night?
One of the things about back to school night is the generational phenomenon. As recently as this year, after the first day of class, all the students come up to me and say, "You taught my mom, you taught my dad, you taught..." It's a very common occurrence, and I've taught possibly even grandchildren, I don't know, but generations of students at the high school. So that's... And often I don't... First of all, I forget names, and then, of course, if it was their mother, often they change their name, so I wouldn't necessarily recognize it. And then the parents who I taught come back to school on back to school night, and they'd often identify. I once had a class in back to school night where at least three or four of the parents are former students of mine, mm-hmm. Yeah. Many of whom had left town but then came back here to live later on. Yeah,
that's great.
Can I ask what drew you? This is Kim. What drew you to the topic of history?
Oh, that goes way back to my childhood. I was always. I don't know exactly what it was. I was just always interested in the past and origins and the story. You know, history at its best is a story. It's a good story. And as a matter of fact, I could get into this in great detail, but one of my criticisms of advanced placement, I mean, here I am. I taught advanced placement for many years. I actually am in favor of getting rid of it. For a number of reasons. But one of my criticisms of the AP advanced placement exam is to the degree you teach to the test, it's almost as if it were designed by people to make you uninterested in history because they've taken the story out of history. That's one of my main criticisms of it. It just becomes a sequence of events without that kind of narrative quality, and that I think what interests people in history, if you talk to people who say they like history, they like the narrative quality about it. People who watch the History Channel are watching it because of the story. So I think that's what really attracted me to it. Yeah.
Did you do any activism in town? I feel like I hear your name come up sometimes, or maybe you wouldn't call it that way.
Yeah, I wouldn't call it that because I don't know that I think of myself. And, I mean, if you could prompt me, Maybe I've done some things.
I just had this notion. I don't know if that's true or not.
Yeah. Mm. No.
Maybe I think it's just that you're recognized.
Yeah.
And well loved.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Yeah.
Very much so.
Is there, as a teacher, is there sort of a lesson or a question that you would give to students or others in terms of looking back on your life or what you think people should do?
Well, yeah, I kind of stumbled into teaching. I sometimes say that I said in an interview recently, in trying to decide whether to become a doctor or a cellist, I became a teacher. And those are really two options I considered somewhat seriously. But in fact, my going into teaching was motivated in part by the war in Vietnam. For a while, it was draft exempt. And I didn't know that, and I really felt I found my calling, but I didn't know it until my first day in front of a class. And I feel too many people have missed their calling because they weren't exposed to what they would have found to be their passion. And I think one thing education ideally can and should do is expose people to many different things. And I think we're not doing that good a job of that. When I was, for example, when I was in high school, one of the subjects all males had to take, talking about gender, is shop. You know, the girls took home ec and the men took shop. But one of the things about it is that it exposed us to something. I would have never have done any woodworking had I not taken shop. I wasn't great at it, but it at least it exposed me to it. And I think we should have mini courses that expose students to all kinds of different options, because they may discover something about themselves they didn't know. Yeah, that would be one of my lessons from my experience. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, thank you so, so much for joining us today and sharing your memories and your experiences. This is the end of the recording.
Thank you.